Welcome to part two of lecture number 11 in our study of biblical hermeneutics. In this second half of the lecture, we hope to finally finish principle number 22, know the different types of literature. Remember, we started this principle back in the second half of lecture number 10, and we still haven't finished. So that means that we have to squeeze the rest of the 30 principles into lecture number 12. Because my tape albums only hold 12 tapes, and the study guide has already been made up, as you can see. So expect to move quickly when we get to lecture number 12. But now let's turn back to handout number 61, the types of biblical literature. We've already talked about historical narrative, apocalyptic literature, prophecy, and then you remember we skipped down to letters. And now we want to discuss poetry as a type of literature or literary genre. Now, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that the Bible contains poetry, especially in the Old Testament. In fact, a whole division of the Old Testament is known as poetry. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. And, of course, many of the other books of the Old Testament contain a significant amount of poetry as well. Hebrew poetry has two primary characteristics, figurative language and parallel structure. All right? So you definitely want to get that down in your notes. Figurative language and parallel structure. Now, in reference to figurative language, turn to handout number 68. Here we have the beautiful Shulamite maiden from the Song of Solomon, illustrated as if the language were literal. How many remember this from Old Testament survey? Okay. Let's read the selections here from the Song of Solomon, chapters 4 and 7. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes. Your lips are like a scarlet thread. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones on which are hung 1,000 shields. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. Your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue. And the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. Your navel is a round goblet. Your belly like a heap of wheat. Selections from the Song of Solomon, chapters 4 and 7. How would you guys here like to go with an Emmaus woman who looked like this? I saw that hand. Well, obviously, we can see that Hebrew poetry is characterized at times by lots of figurative language. And that point must be kept in mind for interpretation. Usually, the figurative language in Hebrew poetry is easy to interpret, but we must recognize that there will be figurative language in poetry. That's the point. Don't force Hebrew poetry into a literal language mold, or you'll end up practicing bad hermeneutics. You know, I remember a Christian friend told me once that he believed that when the Lord came back, all the trees of the forest would literally sing hymns in some way based on Psalm 96, verses 12 and 13. Let me just read that. Let the field exult and all that is in it. Then all the trees of the forest will sing for joy before the Lord, for he is coming. So he thought somehow the trees were literally going to sing hymns, you know, when the Lord came back. Well, I think my friend was failing to see that Hebrew poetry contains figurative language. The other characteristic of Hebrew poetry is its structure, which is called Hebrew parallelism. Turn to handout number 69, Hebrew parallelism. Here we have four types of Hebrew parallelism listed. Synonymous parallelism, antithetic parallelism, emblematic parallelism, and synthetic parallelism. Parallelism has to do with the parallel structure between the lines of Hebrew poetry. One more time. Parallelism has to do with the parallel structure between the lines of Hebrew poetry. In synonymous parallelism, the second line corresponds to the first line by saying about the same thing, just with different words. In antithetic parallelism, the second line corresponds to the first line by giving a contrasting or opposite thought. In emblematic parallelism, the first line corresponds to the second line by giving a word picture which illustrates the thought of the second line. And in synthetic parallelism, one or more lines following the first line correspond to that first line by adding to it or building upon it or completing it. Now let's look at the examples given here on handout number 69. For synonymous parallelism, let's go to Psalm 19, verse 2 as our first example. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. Do you see the parallelism here? Day to day pours forth speech, line 1. And now we have the repetition of a similar thought in line 2. And night to night reveals knowledge. Now, I think you can see the synonymous parallelism in verses 1 and 3 of this psalm as well. Verse 1, the heavens are telling of the glory of God, line 1. And now a similar thought in line 2. And their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. And then verse 3, there is no speech, nor are there words, line 1. And now comes the repetition of the same or similar thought in line 2. Their voice is not heard. You follow that? There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. So right there in the first three verses of Psalm 19, you have synonymous parallelism. And go through the rest of the psalm and all of your Hebrew poetry, you'll find lots of synonymous parallelism. Another example of synonymous parallelism. Psalm 24, verse 1. The earth is the Lord's and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. Everybody follow the synonymous parallelism? The earth is the Lord's and all it contains, line 1. And now comes the similar thought following in line 2. The world and those who dwell in it. One more example of synonymous parallelism. Psalm 25, verse 4. Make me know thy ways, O Lord. Teach me thy paths. You see it? Make me know thy ways, O Lord, line 1. Now the similar thought in line 2. Teach me thy paths. What about antithetic parallelism, where the characteristic is a contrasting or opposite thought in line 2? Let's turn to Psalm 1 and verse 6 as our first example. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. You see the antithetic parallelism there. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, line 1, and now comes the contrasting thought in line 2. But the way of the wicked will perish. Usually the second line, by the way, in antithetic parallelism begins with the word but. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. A second example of antithetic parallelism is in Psalm 18, verse 27. For thou dost save an afflicted people, but haughty eyes thou dost abase. I think you can follow the antithetic parallelism there, right? For thou dost save an afflicted people, line 1. And now the contrasting thought in line 2. But haughty eyes thou dost abase. Now let's look at a couple of examples of emblematic parallelism, where the characteristic is the use of word pictures. First example here of emblematic parallelism, Psalm 42, verse 1. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants for thee, O God. You see the word picture in line 1? As the deer pants for the water brooks? It illustrates the thought of line 2, "So my soul pants for thee, O God." Emblematic parallelism usually employs the as-so format, as we see here. One more time. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants for thee, O God. A second example of emblematic parallelism would be Proverbs 25, verse 25. Like cold water to a weary soul, so is good news from a distant land. There you have the word picture in line 1, like or as cold water to a weary soul. Notice how it illustrates the thought of line 2, so is good news from a distant land. Everybody follow? Okay, that's emblematic parallelism. For synthetic parallelism, turn to Psalm 1 and verse 1. Now, the characteristic of synthetic parallelism is that one thought adds to, builds upon, or completes another thought. Psalm 1. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. That's the first line. That's line 1. Now notice how line 2 builds on line 1. Nor stand in the path of sinners. And then notice how the thought in line 3 adds to line 2. Nor sit in the seat of scoffers. That's synthetic parallelism. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, line 1, nor stand in the path of sinners, line 2, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, line 3. Psalm 23, verses 1 through 3 is another example of synthetic parallelism. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. That's line 1. Now notice how the thoughts in the next 4 lines, in verses 2 and 3, add to the thought of line 1. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. That's synthetic parallelism. All these succeeding lines adding to, building on the thought in verse 1. Now, for our final example of synthetic parallelism, turn to Proverbs 15, verse 17. Better is a dish of vegetables where love is than a fattened ox and hatred with it. Here is a proverb in 2-line Hebrew parallelism. Notice how the second line completes the thought begun in line 1. Better is a dish of vegetables where love is, line 1, than a fattened ox and hatred with it. So this is really an example of synthetic parallelism. Well, I think you can appreciate that there are a number of subcategories of synthetic parallelism, depending on whether succeeding thoughts are adding to, building upon, completing the thought of the first line. In fact, the study of Hebrew parallelism is quite involved, and more detailed ways of classification could be given. We've just scratched the surface here, but I think we've seen enough to at least make us aware of the fact that there is a structure to Hebrew poetry, and that there are different kinds of Hebrew parallelism. And this should be kept in mind when interpreting Hebrew poetry, because one line may help interpret the other line or lines. I think you can see that, right? For example, in Job 38 and verse 7, we read, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Question, if Job 38 verse 7 is synonymous parallelism, then most likely what do the morning stars refer to? Answer, angels, right. Since the second line refers to angels as sons of God, most likely the morning stars, which is parallel in the first line, refers to angels as well. You see that? Knowing about the structure of Hebrew poetry and Hebrew parallelism can help us in interpretation. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Well, there's more we could say, but we need to move on and discuss the interpretation of our next type of literature, and that is wisdom literature, as we can see on handout number 61. Anybody have any questions at this point? Someone asked a question about the angels being referred to as both sons of God and morning stars in Job 38:7. Well, the term sons of God is definitely used for angels in the Old Testament. In Job chapters 1 and 2, we read that the sons of God presented themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. So the term sons of God can even refer to evil angels. As to the term morning stars referring to angels, not only do we have what appears to be synonymous parallelism here in Job 38:7, but in Isaiah chapter 14, we have further support. In Isaiah 14, we have a reference, we believe, to the fall of Satan. I'm reading Isaiah 14, verse 12. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? That's the King James Version. Now let me read it in the New American Standard. How have you fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn? So we see that the idea of Job 38:7 being synonymous parallelism with the terms sons of God and morning stars, both referring to angels, is backed up with other scripture. Note, by the way, in Job 38:7 that all the sons of God shouted for joy. This would certainly be support for the position that Satan did not fall until after creation week. You all follow that? Well, a lot more we could say at this point, but we've got to move on. Our sixth type of biblical literature mentioned on handout number 61 is wisdom literature. Wisdom literature, as a type of biblical literature, contains very practical and down-to-earth advice and counsel from God. Wisdom literature is wisdom for living. Now, who can tell me the name of a book in Scripture which is wisdom literature? You got it, the book of Proverbs. The outstanding book of wisdom literature in the Bible is the book of Proverbs. What about other wisdom literature in the Bible? Job and Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament are also considered wisdom literature because they too reflect on the mysteries of life, including the purpose of suffering in Job and questions concerning what life is all about in Ecclesiastes. So in this way, you see, these books are also filled with wisdom for living and are thus wisdom literature. In the New Testament, the book of James comes the closest to wisdom literature. James is very practical and down to earth and tells how faith works in everyday life. So there is wisdom literature in the Bible besides the book of Proverbs, but Proverbs is certainly the best known wisdom literature in Scripture. So here we have a book of Hebrew poetry that is wisdom literature. Proverbs is very practical and down to earth and loaded with sanctified common sense. If you want to gain wisdom for living, read a chapter of Proverbs every day, each month for a year. As you know, there are 31 chapters in the book of Proverbs, one chapter for each day of the month. Wait a minute, you say, what about the 30-day months? Well, read two chapters on the last day of 30-day months, and read four chapters on the last day of February. Do this for a year and you will gain a lot of wisdom for living because Proverbs is wisdom literature. I'm reading a note now from the introduction to the book of Proverbs in the Ryrie Study Bible. Though the theme running throughout the book is wisdom for living, the specific teachings include instruction on folly, sin, goodness, wealth, poverty, the tongue, pride, humility, justice, vengeance, strife, gluttony, love, lust, laziness, friends, the family, life, and death. Almost every facet of human relationships is mentioned, and the teaching of the book is applicable to all men everywhere. It's a note from the introduction to Proverbs in the Ryrie Study Bible. Now, when it comes to interpreting Proverbs, the best piece of advice to remember is Proverbs are Proverbs. Now, let's elaborate on what we mean by that statement, Proverbs are Proverbs. Proverbs are wise sayings. They are not popular sayings like March comes in like a lion and goes out like a lamb. That's a popular saying. No, Proverbs are rather wise sayings like the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, Proverbs 9:10, and Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before stumbling. Note the synonymous parallelism there, by the way. Remember, Proverbs is Hebrew poetry. Let me read that again. See the synonymous parallelism? Pride goes before destruction, line 1, and a haughty spirit before stumbling, line 2, saying just about the same thing in different words, synonymous parallelism. But what we're saying is Proverbs is not only Hebrew poetry, it's wisdom literature, and so here you have a wise saying. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling. A wise saying. And Proverbs are moralistic pronouncements, like Proverbs 14, verse 19. The evil will bow down before the good, and the wicked at the gates of the righteous. Let's read another one. Proverbs 19, 9. A false witness will not go unpunished, and he who tells lies will perish. Certain government officials in high office in this country should read this proverb. A false witness will not go unpunished, and he who tells lies will perish. When interpreting Proverbs, it must be remembered that Proverbs are general truths stated in general terms. Very important point. Proverbs are general truths stated in general terms. They are not moral absolutes. But that does not mean that proverbs are sometimes false. A proverb cannot be false by definition. It is a general truth stated in general terms. And this must be kept in mind for hermeneutics. Truth stated in proverb form is not interpreted the same as truth stated in precept form. Now let's see if we can illustrate that with some truths taught here at Emmaus Bible College. The Bible teaches that a man and a woman should be married before starting a family. We teach that truth here at Emmaus, right? The Bible teaches that a man and a woman should be married before starting a family. Now, that's truth stated in precept form. But now, here at Emmaus, we also teach that Christian marriages result in better home and family life. Christian marriages result in better home and family life. Now, that's truth taught in proverb form. Wait a minute, you say. I know this Christian couple. In fact, they even went to Emmaus Bible College, and they studied the Bible, and they have a terrible marriage, and their family life is chaotic and up for grabs. Does that exception falsify Christian marriages result in better home and family life? No, because it's truth in proverb form. It's a general truth stated in general terms. And in general, Christian marriages do result in better home and family life. Another example from here at Emmaus Bible College. Emmaus Bible College students must take Bible courses in order to graduate. That's truth stated in precept form. Now here's a truth stated in proverb form. Emmaus Bible College students make better Sunday school teachers. Yes, unfortunately, there are some Emmaus graduates that are not good Sunday school teachers. But that does not make this statement false, because it's a general truth stated in general terms. It's truth in proverb form. Emmaus Bible College students make better Sunday school teachers. I think that's easy enough to follow, right? Now let's look at Proverbs 18, verse 22. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. I heard a few amens. But wait a minute, you say. What's the Bible teaching here anyway? Does that mean you must be married in order to find favor with the Lord? Doesn't God call some people to be single? Aren't there some bad marriages, even bad Christian marriages? Aren't there exceptions to this Bible verse? Well, how do we answer all these questions? This is a proverb, a general truth stated in general terms. In general, it is true that it's good for a man to be married, and this finds favor with God. Remember, proverbs are proverbs. Let's look at Proverbs 31, verses 6 and 7 as our next example. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more. What? Is this the Bible I'm reading? Anybody here this morning bitter with life? Anybody bitter with life right now? Anyone have troubles? Well, see me after class and we'll go out and have a drink together. So you can forget your troubles. Well, is this good hermeneutics or bad hermeneutics? Who said good? Well, let's keep two things in mind as we properly interpret these verses. First of all, these verses are not condoning drinking and intoxication, but rather the use of alcohol for medicinal purposes. Look back at verses 4 and 5, as far as the context goes. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to desire strong drink, lest they drink and forget what is decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. So the context is against drinking. But strong drink can be used as a medicine, as we see in verses 6 and 7. I believe Proverbs 31, 6 and 7 gives us a biblical basis for the use of pain-killing drugs to alleviate suffering. A second point that must be kept in mind when interpreting Proverbs 31, 6 and 7 is that it's a proverb. Remember, proverbs are general truths stated in general terms. Even for medicinal purposes, we don't want to follow these verses as a commandment, as if it was one of the Ten Commandments. No. Remember, this is a proverb, a general truth stated in general terms. There may be many cases where someone's life is bitter, and you don't give them strong drink. There may be many cases where it would not be the right thing to do to help a person forget their troubles this way. It's a proverb, a general truth stated in general terms. Well, I think you can see how we must be very careful how we interpret the proverbs. We must remember they're not absolute precepts. Rather, they are proverbs, general truths stated in general terms. Now let's turn to Proverbs 22, verse 6, for our next example. And in order to save time, let's read handout number 70, which is a Devotions for Growing Christians entitled, Proverbs Are Proverbs. Proverbs 22, 6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22, 6. Many Christian parents have claimed Proverbs 22:6 as a wonderful promise concerning their children, a promise that their sons and daughters would turn out to be model Christian young people. Some Christian parents, however, have been extremely disappointed and even bitter towards God when their kids have turned out to be anything but model Christians. Some rebellious Christian teenagers have even gotten themselves into big trouble. What happened anyway? Is God not true to his word? Does he make exceptions to his promises? Did the parents claim a promise that really isn't a promise? What is the biblical solution that will answer these upsetting questions? If you read the commentaries on the book of Proverbs for an explanation of the exceptions to the promise of Proverbs 22:6, you will find that several different solutions are suggested. It may be that there is some validity to all of these solutions, depending on the particular home situation in which the proverb is applied. For example, one approach is to place the emphasis on the word old. A person who holds this view might say, the proverb does not guarantee that there will be no teenage rebellion, But if you train up children in the right way, when they are old, they will follow that good training. Although they may sow a few wild oats in their adolescent years, they will eventually come around and toe the line. The temporary boys will be boys pattern that they are following now will soon be changed for a faith of the fathers blueprint for the rest of their lives. Although this solution looks quite reasonable at first, it isn't long before we realize that it has one major drawback. It doesn't always hold true. While many teenage rebels experience a happy turnaround, many cases do not have happy endings. Some, quote, graduates of Christian homes have literally self-destructed through substance abuse. Others have ended up as basket cases when it comes to the matter of being Christian spouses and parents. Far from being models, some have followed unprincipled and immoral lifestyles, sometimes living even more reprehensible lives than individuals with no Christian upbringing. There have been well-trained, quote, Christian dropouts who have actually turned willfully against God and become outspoken atheists throughout their lives, turning many others away from the way of truth as well. Even when they are old, they do not depart from their evil ways. Certainly the when they are old approach to Proverbs 22:6 does not hold in these cases. Another approach to resolving the apparent exceptions to Proverbs 22:6 has been to focus attention on the training up portion of the proverb. People who take this approach to the proverb would say, when you see what looks like an exception to the proverb, it is because you haven't fully scrutinized the training program of that individual. The Christian home may have looked good from the outside, but what was the home life really like? Just because the family went to church every Sunday and participated in Christian ministries does not mean that the proper training of the children was going on in the home. There may have been all kinds of problems behind the closed doors of what appeared to be a model Christian home. Discipline may have been lax. Family devotions may have been a rarity. Control of what the children read or watched on TV may have been neglected. Real communication may have been virtually non-existent. And love between parents and children may have been unexpressed or minimal. The teenage products of such homes are not exceptions to Proverbs 22:6 at all, but are rather proof that they were not trained up in the way that they should go. Here again, we have a solution that looks good and is probably an answer in some cases, but it is not an answer that solves all the, quote, exceptions to Proverbs 22:6. There are numerous cases of Christian parents who have been diligent and dedicated in the godly training and proper upbringing of their children and yet have been sadly disappointed with the results. These parents were not, quote, Sunday-only Christians, and their homes were not just a Christian facade. These people were men and women of God who have earnestly built Christ-centered homes with lots of love. The fact that some of their children have departed from the faith cannot be blamed on the training program. No, this solution does not give a satisfactory answer to the cases of young adults from fine Christian homes who have rebelled and departed from the faith. A somewhat different approach to Proverbs 22:6 could be called the amoral or non-moral interpretation. This interpretation would say, the proverb is not talking about the training of children as to moral and spiritual values, but rather the development of their natural abilities and interests. Children need help and direction in order to develop their God-given talents. If they are trained in line with their abilities, they will reach their full potential in adult years. They will live fulfilled lives, and thus they will not depart from the way they should go. While this interpretation of Proverbs 22:6 has some merit, it doesn't take a lot of insight to realize that there are exceptions even to this point of view. Not every child who has his or her natural abilities and interests developed, even to a maximum by experts, follows such a course through life. Limiting the proverb to natural talents and abilities does not get us off the hook as far as the exceptions go. So while Proverbs 22:6 may be applied to the non-moral aspects of a child's upbringing, let us not eliminate the spiritual and moral spheres from the scope of this promise. Remember that throughout the book of Proverbs, the way a person should go is the way of wisdom, and the way of wisdom is inseparable from moral integrity and spiritual maturity. We need to look further for the full answer as to why at times this proverb seems not to hold true. Appreciation for the nature of a proverb is of tremendous help in understanding the promise of Proverbs 22:6. Proverbs are general truths stated in general terms. A proverb is not a precept. A precept is a truth stated in absolute terms. An illustration may help here. Suppose we are making statements of truth about engineering students at a particular university. One statement might be, a student must take and pass calculus in order to graduate as an engineer. That statement of truth is in precept form. There are no exceptions. But suppose we said, students who do well in calculus make better engineers. That is also a statement of truth, but it is in proverb form. It is a general truth stated in general terms. But there may be some exceptions. There may be a few engineering graduates from that university who are very good engineers, but never did well in calculus. And by the same token, there may be a few graduates who were A-plus students in calculus, but they have not made very good engineers. These exceptions, however, do not make the statement false, because it is a general truth stated in general terms. Exceptions do not make a proverb false. Proverbs are proverbs. Proverbs are not precepts. They are general truths stated in general terms. Proverbs 22:6 is a proverb. The occasional case which proves to be an exception to the general truth does not make this proverb false. A brief look at a few of the other proverbs in this chapter further demonstrates the nature of a proverb. The truths of verses 4, 11, and 29, for example, are not always binding. They are usually true, but a little reflection of these proverbs will bring to mind a number of exceptions. Humility and the fear of the Lord do not always bring riches and honor and life. Verse 4. Rulers are not always friends with the gracious and pure of heart. Verse 11. And there are skilled people who have remained in obscurity, unrecognized by kings. Verse 29. Does this mean that we can expect some exceptions? Very important point here, by the way. Does this mean that we can expect some exceptions to all the Proverbs? What about the well-known promise of Proverbs 3, 5, and 6? Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and don't depend on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. That's Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Can't we take this promise as more than a general truth and claim it without exception? Yes, we can. Why? What's the difference between this proverb and Proverbs 22:6? The truth of any proverb that is supported by other scriptures, which are not proverbs, can be taken as more than a proverb. The promise in Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 of direction in life as a result of depending on the Lord is without exception. It is more than a general truth because it is stated explicitly in other scriptures. Take James 1:5, for example, which is a promise made to the believer who is walking by faith. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask of God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. Here is the same basic truth of Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, but it is not in proverb form. Looking to God by faith and receiving wisdom for life's decisions is more than a general truth. It is without exception. The general truths stated in many, if not most, of the Proverbs are shown by the rest of Scripture to be more than general truths. Thus, most of the time, we are on safe ground when quoting a proverb as an absolute truth without exception. However, the proverb that well-trained children will not depart from their good upbringing is a general truth that is not backed up explicitly by the rest of Scripture as an absolute truth, without exception. In fact, when the Apostle Paul alludes to Proverbs 22:6 in Ephesians 6:4, it is significant that he does not include the promise part of the proverb. Children are to be brought up quote, in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, end of quote, with no absolute guarantee of results. The good news of Proverbs 22:6, of course, is that there is a promise here for parents. The fact that it is a general truth and cannot be claimed as an absolute guarantee of salvation or straight living for every single child should not discourage Christian parents. Parents who train up their children in the way they should go can be confident that normally, with very few exceptions, their discipline efforts are going to be rewarded with the salvation and spiritual well-being of their children. Does anyone have a question at this point before we move to our next type of biblical literature? Once again, let's look at handout number 61, the last type of biblical literature or literary genre that we have listed here is parables. Now, remember, we talked about parables back under principle number 12, be careful about spiritualization. Interpreting parables in the New Testament is very similar to interpreting types in the Old Testament. There are two dangerous extremes, either reading too much meaning into the details of the parable or not seeing the details that God intended to have meaning. Think of parables as verbal pictures. Focus on the main point that the artist, the Lord Himself, wants to convey. Then let any details give support to that main idea. Don't isolate the interpretation of the details from the main thrust of the parable. Now, we saw this back under principle number 12 in reference to the parable of the sower. Remember handout number 41. The same, then, is true of the rest of the parables in Matthew 13 and all the parables. For example, in the interpretation of the parable of the virgins in Matthew 25, the Lord gives the main thrust of the parable's meaning in verse 13. Be on the alert, then, for you do not know the day nor the hour. So what's the main thrust of this parable? To be ready. To be ready for the Lord's return really is the main focus of the parable. Now, details of this parable that have meaning and are not just background should somehow support that central idea. To push the doctrine that you can lose your salvation because the foolish virgins said in verse 8, our lamps are going out, that's departing from the main focus of the parable. We believe it contradicts the rest of Scripture as well. On the other hand, to see the detail that there are 10 virgins, and 10 is the number of responsibility throughout Scripture, and thus interpret the parable as emphasizing that we have a responsibility to be ready. You see, this does not take away from the main focus of the parable. In fact, it adds to it. You all follow that? Well, there are many features concerning the details of this parable that add to the main idea of the church's responsibility to be ready for the Lord's return. And they support the main idea to be ready for the Lord's return. Anybody have any questions now? Amy? Yes. The question was, when you read a parable and you read about people and places and objects, is it okay to read meaning in? Yes, but watching out for these two dangerous extremes. Namely, don't go pushing every detail because it may just be background like you have in any picture. On the other hand, don't lose out on some of the beauty of the details if that's what God intended. So how do you figure out, right? Well, what I'm saying is look for the main thrust of the artist, the main focus. Here in the parable of the virgins, you can clearly see it. The Lord tells us, verse 13, right? Be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour. So the main thrust of this parable is be ready, right? Everybody see that? So now when you go to interpreting the details, if the detail supports that main thrust, and you're not just going to the parable to try to read in your pet doctrine or something like that, you know, it's like a verbal picture. The details may indeed support the main thrust, but on the other hand, it might be just background. That's your key for being on safe ground hermeneutically for interpreting parables. Look for the main thrust. What's the artist, God himself, intending to convey with that verbal picture? See the main thrust. Now, when you go to the details, those details should support that main focus and not be some doctrine that may be biblically correct, but it's not really what's the intention and focus of the parable.